How much do we know about the Cold War?
We'll find that actually the Cold War wasn't so cold.
It was a real conflict.
Do we have the full picture?
It's often from the North's perspective.
We want to get the story right. We've just got to include the Global South.
Global South or the Third World.
This is The Secret Struggle for Cold War Dominance, a podcast that brings stories.
He was a man without a country.
Facts.
Czechoslovakia provided Cuban intelligence.
And historical background.
These were places where stakes were too high.
Of the secret and untold Cold War. Hello? Episode 11, The Vicious Struggle Between Profit and Influence. Welcome to The Secret Struggle for Cold War Dominance, a podcast in which we look at the untold stories of the Cold War, highlighting the fact that it was not just a conflict between the USSR and the US, but that in fact it was a global war, reaching to all parts of the world. We've done our fair share of putting the more junior players like Poland, the UK, Morocco, or East Germany in the spotlight, emphasizing their role in the whole Cold War struggle. We've spoken about emerging or newly independent countries or countries undergoing turmoil like Tanzania or Congo, asking for assistance in the field of military and intelligence, and then other countries, small or big, granting them that aid, free or for profit, with or without a hidden agenda. Today, we'll take a rare, close look at what this assistance, military assistance, looked like during the Cold War. Imagine you're a young guy, Fuad from Egypt. You're in your 20s, studying at the Alexandria Military Academy, tank engineering. Egypt under Nasser has become close friends with the USSR, fighting off the Brits and the French in the Suez Canal. But there's always something happening, security-wise, in the region. So you're sent for a two-year-long training in military engineering to a small country half across the globe away, in the middle of Europe, Czechoslovakia. You don't know anyone there, there is no Facebook to help out with local friends, you don't speak the language, so you're sent there half a year earlier to learn the basics. You're not alone in this, there's three of you going into this training. It's February 1959, you've just come from sunny Egypt and entered the height of winter in Czechoslovakia. What awaits you here? And what does military training in a country that is a part of the USSR socialist camp look like? Today, we'll go to Czechoslovakia, inside these cadet barracks and training centers, to learn about the dailiness of special assistance, about influence and profit, and much more, of course. Yes, we'll talk training. Getting out of hand.
They were thinking, you know, are they just eager instructors from a partner academy, or are they actually trying to go beyond what we're willing to provide them with?
We'll talk training facilities, getting out of hand.
You know, we're not ready for such big numbers.
We'll talk cadets, getting out of hand.
He ripped his shirt apart and threw away his wallet and he said, you know, you wouldn't believe what happened to me. I got kidnapped by a number of Czechoslovaks.
And we'll talk Czechoslovakia, getting out of hand.
The Prague Spring, the several years in the 1960s which saw a liberalization of the communist regime in Czechoslovakia, were actually really good for arms business.
Yes, we have a cool show ahead of us, so here we go. Welcome to The Secret Struggle for Cold War Dominance. My name is Katarina Urban-Richterova. And welcome to Czechoslovakia. It's the mid-1950s, a decade since World War II ended, that brutally affected Czechoslovakia. The country was split up, its citizens were murdered in concentration camps. Eventually, Slovaks organized an uprising against their own Nazi leadership. After World War II, the Czechs and Slovaks got together again to create a common Czechoslovakia. And a few years in, Czechoslovak communists seized power in the country, of course with Soviet backing. And communism would dominate the country's politics for the next four decades. bananas and oranges could only be bought in the stores at Christmas. Special products from the West could be purchased only in specialized shops, paid for by a special currency, available only to the privileged few. And throughout the country, there was shortage and a waiting list for everything. And how do I know this? I was there. Although not in the 1960s, a few decades later, but still, I know firsthand the former communist Czechoslovakia. And so do these two historians who are helping me today tell the story of Czechoslovakia.
Hello, my name is Natalia Telepneva. I am a lecturer in international history at the University of Strathclyde.
The name Natalia is interchangeable in Russian with Natasha, so you might hear us call Natalia Natasha as well. It's still the same person.
Hello, my name is Doctor. Did you say Doctor? My name is Dr. Daniela Richterova, and I am a lecturer in intelligence studies at Brunel University, London.
Is that a strange thing to say that you're a doctor?
It's very strange. I don't know. I guess I never really thought of my doctorate as a exercise which would earn me a title. For me, it was basically a way to spend time reading and writing and playing detective.
I have to add a short disclaimer here. Daniela is my sister, a fantastic historian and university lecturer with a very similar voice to mine. So if you're ever in doubt who's saying what, just keep in mind that it's Daniela who's saying the smart things.
And was that the same for you?
It was all about the title for me and the robe, actually. So yeah, that was really, really important.
Maybe it's a good idea also to say what countries you come from. It might explain a little more why we're talking about this topic.
So I was born in Czechoslovakia, but am Slovak now. So yeah, the first couple of years of my life, I was a Czechoslovak.
Natalia?
I'm Russian. I'm a Soviet historian as well.
And we also have to say that this paper was also put together with a third co-author. His name is Dr. Mikuláš Pešta from the Charles University, and he's from the Czech Republic. So Daniela, Natalia and myself, we all know the joy of receiving an orange for Christmas. That's what the 1950s to the 1980s were like in the Eastern Bloc. And from the more global perspective, and in the world of espionage, military and intelligence assistance, the 1950s
is a really exciting time for the Global South or the Third World. This is a time of rapid decolonization in Africa, and it's also a period when there is increasing rivalry between sort of the superpowers, right, United States and Soviet Union, and general rivalry over influence in the Third World. So it's also a really dramatic and interesting period for the socialist bloc, because on the one hand you have destalinization. At the same time, this is a time when not just the Soviet Union and the United States, but increasingly Eastern European countries start engaging with the Third World, increasingly so. So it's a kind of a time of rediscovery of the Third World. Specifically for Czechoslovakia, this is a time of extremely active engagement in the Third World, you know. Once Nikita Khrushchev sort of kind of denounces Stalin, there is a new relationship with the Eastern Bloc countries, and actually Khrushchev partly encourages Eastern European countries to pursue kind of very active foreign policy in the Third World. So Czechoslovakia kind of takes this on in a very active way, and you know, opens new embassies across Asia, Africa, Latin America.
So it's the 1950s. Czechoslovakia, just like Poland, Bulgaria and other Eastern Bloc countries, are shown the green light from the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev to spread the word of communism and socialism, go and make some friends and get some new business while you're out there, in the Third World, Latin America, Asia or Africa. And so they do. They start doing business with the Third World and also providing them with special assistance.
So special assistance was a euphemism that the Czechoslovaks, but I would argue that also other countries in the Eastern Bloc, used as a term to denote a number of clandestine types of assistance.
Clandestine meaning covert or secret.
And the type of special assistance that we are looking at is arms supplies, arms sales to these Global South countries.
Yes, Czechoslovakia Slovakia was exporting a wide variety of products, ranging from fighter knives, small guns, pistols and explosives, to RPGs, tanks and freighter jets. Yes, surprisingly perhaps, this small country of no more than 13 million people was quite a player on the arms market.
Prague was a famous arms producer and exporter, and in the 1950s, this became really handy to Moscow when Moscow wanted to use military assistance as a means of its influence. It was very handy that they had Czechoslovakia on their side and happy to become their junior partner in such assistance.
Right, so Czechoslovakia started providing arms to, well, all over the world, really, but was also sending abroad advisors.
There were hundreds of Czechoslovak advisors sent to places such as Cuba, such as Egypt, Iraq, later on to Libya to train locally.
Right, until now, and the recent research of Telepneva, Richterova and Pešta, Czechoslovak military assistance was a bit of a black box in history. On top of providing arms and sending in advisors, Czechoslovakia created this nice package and started providing training to go along with the arms they were selling.
Basically training everyone from sharpshooters to engineers to operate all of this equipment. So it is about teaching combat to some of these Global South soldiers or security officers who are giving some of these weapons. But it's also quite mundane stuff about how do you repair this tank and how do you clean this RPG. We did not find a clear-cut final number of how many trainees from the Global South came to Czechoslovakia or how many were trained in their own countries. But we know that in the mid-1950s, when Czechoslovakia became a part of a very famous arms sales deal between basically the Soviet Union and Egypt in 1955, that arms sales and military equipment sales deal also entailed training of Egyptian soldiers to operate this material, which was later on crucial in some of the Middle Eastern wars. And these are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Egyptian military staff. And there are, I would say, hundreds of them who came to Czechoslovakia to be trained. And there's further hundreds at home who are being trained in operating this equipment.
After the Egypt training deal, Prague, the capital of Czechoslovakia, became the it place for military training and services.
Prague really becomes the go-to capital in Eastern Europe, where a lot of, for example, African leaders come increasingly asking for arms and asking for training.
After Egypt come other countries, come the Syrians, come the Indonesians, then the Cubans. And basically between 1956 and 1965, there's almost 2,000 cadets from 14 countries who come to Czechoslovakia to receive different types of training or are trained in their own home countries.
Right. While it sounded like a good, profitable business, it was definitely an unpredictable one. It's difficult to accommodate hundreds, dozens, but at times also just seven students. But on top of that, imagine there are no ordinary students, but soldiers, specialists and cadets that are being trained in military strategy, operating and maintaining military equipment. So you can't just put them up in hotels in the city. For this kind of training, you need to have staff and infrastructure, one that at times might be overcrowded and at other times completely empty.
Czechoslovak military instructors were either inexperienced or overwhelmed by their daily duties.
There were few qualified interpreters, and even those that were, often lacked technical English, French, or Arabic language skills. Textbooks and models of equipment were also usually unavailable.
For instance, in autumn 1959, 12 United Arab Republic cadets were trained to use Soviet ammunition at the Novaki artillery base.
Their Czechoslovak instructors complained that they did not have any models or cuts of the appropriate ammunition and were only teaching off of simple drawings or templates, which seemed amateurish.
As the cadets had no textbooks, they found it hard to keep up and make useful notes from lectures. Accommodated at Hotel Hviezda, which provided guests with hot water only once a week, and driven to and from their training facility in a freezing van, cadets suffered from frequent colds.
So this is a paragraph from your paper, actually, talking about the state of the facilities and really what it was like to accommodate so many different cadets.
Yes, basically these programs weren't run very well, especially in the beginning. And Prague, frankly, struggles with accommodating this pretty quick influx. And the Ministry of Defense often complains to their counterparts at the Ministry of Foreign Trade, saying, you know, we're not ready for such big numbers.
So in economic terms, the product Czechoslovakia created and sold was in high demand. In the era of the 1960s, this was understandable, as many African countries were gaining their independence and needed to set up their own armies. So that's good for Czechoslovakia. Some countries like Cuba, for instance, wanted too much too fast, and Czechoslovakia had to learn how to say no. In the early 1960s, Czechoslovakia realizes it has a good product, lots of interest in it, and apart from the numerous facilities it already had and used, it starts setting up new specialized facilities for training cadets from third world countries. One was the foreign faculty of the Antonín Zápotocký Academy, and one was an aviation training center. What was it like to have on a military facility people from different countries of the world who were probably friendly with Czechoslovakia but might not have been? Was there a problem also with protecting its own for Czechoslovakia?
Yes, so the very fact that Czechoslovakia invited these foreigners to a clandestine military facility was a problem, and it was a problem throughout. There was a little bit of what we academics call cognitive dissonance. So there was this conflict there within the minds of the people who were running the military academy. Was, yes, we want to invite these foreigners over, we want to train them, we want to turn them into good engineers, into good sharpshooters, whatever course they're here for, good pilots. But on the other hand, they are not nationals of our country, so we don't want them to know all our secrets and to be familiar with all of the military technology that we have here. In particular, in the 1960s, there was actually a visit from Cairo Military College who came to the Czechoslovak Military Academy, and they were hosted there for a little while and were trained and were showed how a military academy can be run. And these guys seemed like they were, Czechoslovak said, a little bit nosy. They were going around the installation. They were eager to see all sorts of rooms and see different teaching materials. And according to the Czechoslovaks, were making notes in Arabic in unauthorized notepads, and this made the Czechoslovaks very uneasy, very anxious. They were thinking, you know, are they just eager instructors from a partner academy, or are they actually trying to go beyond what we're willing to provide them with? In the end of the day, what the Czechoslovaks did to prevent these guys from walking into some of the areas that were restricted, they took off all of the restricted signs or top secret signs so that these Arab lecturers would not go to those areas which were meant to be off limits. It points to a bigger picture, which is basically about intelligence, military and security liaison, cooperation between states during the Cold War or today. Where do you draw the lines? How far do you allow your partners to learn your know-how?
Czechoslovakia was also pretty good at providing training in security and intelligence. However, in the 1950s and 60s, military training was the big thing they were providing. So that's why we'll concentrate on it in this episode. Most third world trainees wanted training for pilots, aviation technicians, and military engineers. Given the wide variety of trainees and countries they were from, their programs were tailor-made, and most involved theory and practical exercise. Apart from the fact that the Czechoslovaks were trying to catch up to the high demand for their military training services, it was surprisingly difficult to host such an array of cultures, nations, and backgrounds in a country completely foreign to these soldiers.
Bringing together basically young men from across the world into a military installation which wants them to follow strict military discipline isn't always a smooth sailing exercise. Some of these guys basically were new to the industry. They weren't professional soldiers, so they didn't really like the rules. And some of these cadets thought of their stay in Czechoslovakia as a more of a reward or a holiday and less of an actual training exercise. But ultimately, there were all sorts of problematic behaviors. This was a clandestine program, so the Czechoslovak authorities didn't really want them to engage with the locals. But we found instances where some of these cadets had fathered children with local women. There were also instances when some of these cadets didn't feel like observing curfew and coming back home. We found one story where an Afghan cadet really didn't feel like going back to the military academy by midnight, so he just stayed over at his girlfriend's. And then on the next day when he woke up, and frankly he was quite drunk when he came to bed, so when he woke up he realized, you know, this probably wasn't the smartest thing to do. So he came up with this incredible plan where he ripped his shirt apart and threw away his wallet and his keys and his watch, and he sort of turned up and walked up to the military academy, and he said, you know, you wouldn't believe what happened to me. I got kidnapped by a number of Czechoslovaks and they stole my watch and they stole my wallet and then they kicked me out of the car and all that. Well, first of all, these kind of events were quite uncommon at the time in Czechoslovakia. Second of all, I think his name was Mohamed Jakub. He already had a bit of a credibility problem, so he basically wasn't really believed by his commanding officers because he also smelled of alcohol quite a lot. So there were all sorts of incredible stories that these guys try to make up to get out of some of this disciplinary measures that were an inherent part of this training program.
Yes, many interesting stories crawl out of the formerly secret files of the Czechoslovak secret police about their training facilities and the trainees.
But there were also some other issues, maybe when it came to the preparedness of these cadets. For instance, it was quite fascinating to see reports about the quality of the men who were sent over from all the way from Indonesia to Czechoslovakia to be trained as pilots. The Czechoslovaks found out that with some of these groups of Indonesians, it was almost literally impossible to teach them how to fly because they had fear of flying.
Must have been some fascinating reading. And what does the source information of this kind of information look like? Is it letters of complaints from the cadets, or how do you know these things?
We have basically syllabuses and module guides of these training programs from the Antonín Zápotocký Military Academy that had its own files, and we had access to many of these files. And so we see names of cadets, we see how they performed, there's assessments of how they performed in these training programs. So you could say that we have documents that detail the everyday life and the nitty-gritty of being trained in a Czechoslovak military installation.
Did you get a chance to maybe speak to some of those trainees from way back when? Was it possible?
I think this is one of the biggest challenges that faces historians when they're trying to do this kind of history of relations between the former Soviet bloc countries and the global south, because all the documents we have are written from the point of view of, you know, either the Soviets or here, you know, the Czechoslovak actors, and they come with their own prejudices, with their own language. So it wouldn't be fair for us to assume that these were really how the experiences were from the other side, right? So we really don't know exactly how these programs felt, how they were experienced by the cadets.
We were not able to find any of the hundreds of soldiers and cadets who were trained in Czechoslovakia during the Cold War. Yes, it was a long time ago, but still, some of these soldiers could still be around. Let's try to use the power of podcasting and do a quick blind call out. If you are or know of someone who has been trained in Czechoslovakia for special assistance programs at any position, soldier, cadet, or special whatever, do reach out to us. We'd love to find out more about what the program was like from the other side. Right, so that's the human stories behind being trained as soldiers or for special missions. Now, apart from running a very difficult special assistance program that sometimes felt like a unidorm on steroids, Czechoslovakia had other concerns with the program.
The more fundamental conflict within Czechoslovakia was about basically the conflict between money and influence. Who will we be training, and will we prioritize economic benefit over political ideological influence, or do we do it vice versa? So we were quite surprised to find these very frank, very testy debates, open debates between these government officials.
Yes, big questions. Money and influence.
I think this is probably one of the most exciting parts of the story. And what we've discovered here is that there was a real conflict between the struggle for profits on one hand and the struggle for influence on the other hand, which really kind of changes our understanding of Czechoslovak policy in the Third World, because increasingly historians argue that it was all about profits. But what we found is that there was real debate, there was real conflict between these two sides.
Yes, on one hand, the arms sale and military training is good, profitable business in hard foreign currencies, but it was also much more than that. Czechoslovakia would sometimes give out military training for free, to Algeria, for instance, calling it a purely political project, playing the so-called long game here. How so? Well, it was getting its hand in the pie while it was being baked, for the lack of a better analogy, meaning that by being there when a country is being set up and its security apparatus is being set up, teaching it and training it means getting some power in the service structures and possibly a foot in the door of the new politicians. And that's worth something, right? Especially at a time when the whole world is playing the East versus West game, struggling for dominance. Arms sales and military or intelligence training was definitely perceived as a controversial policy tool. However, the small Czechoslovakia looked like it wanted in on the game. So why was Czechoslovakia sought out by Third World countries for their military training?
For many Third World leaders, Czechoslovakia seemed to be perhaps a bit less threatening than the Soviet Union in comparison to the Soviets, who are kind of a big superpower, right? There is an understanding that perhaps if we acquire our training in Czechoslovakia, you know, Czechoslovakia will not try to and reduce one's sovereignty or try to impose conditions. So it seemed to be a better alternative.
As the research of Telep Neiva, Pešta and Richterova confirms, Prague did check in with Moscow and coordinate with its Soviet bloc partners before taking on a new client or providing military aid or training. Prague was heavily influenced and controlled by Moscow. It was perceived as the big mother of the small Eastern Bloc countries, and Czechoslovakia or Poland or Bulgaria were perceived as its children or the small junior players that do whatever Moscow orders them to. This was the general understanding of how the power play of the Eastern Bloc worked. Surprisingly though, the formerly secret documents that Pešta, Telep Neiva and Richterova found tell a different story.
Communist countries were by no measure these monolithic bureaucracies that were following orders from Moscow and following one particular policy line. These were bureaucracies in which rather resembled some of the Western models we're used to, where each ministry has its own agenda, it has its own motivation, it has its own budget, it has its own expertise, and it is willing and able to go into turf wars with other ministries over important domestic or foreign policy issues.
Surprisingly, Czechoslovakia sought out business in the Third World for the good of the Eastern Bloc and the USSR, but not just that. They did it also for their own good, for their own business and influence. So, all's going well for Czechoslovakia in the special assistance, arms and training sphere. It's building a special site for these trainings when, in the beginning of the 1960s, the number of special assistance trainings drops. Big time. Training capacities, the aviation center, they're half empty. And in the heart of it all was your standard quarrel over who does what. You see, the military training was a joint program of the Defense Ministry that provided the actual training and the Trade Ministry that secured the deals and negotiated the contracts. And of course, both of these ministries were working under the political guidance of the Communist Party.
Documents from the Ministry of Defense claim that basically the Ministry of Trade are doing it wrong. So they can come up with lots of proposals how to increase the volume of trade.
Czechoslovak foreign, defense and trade ministries all felt this special assistance, arms and training deals were part of their turf. And they all had their own ideas of how this business should be run, operated and charged for. Of course, this is just one of the reasons why the amount of assistant trainings dropped so suddenly. Another one was prices. In comparison to the Western competitors, Prague's prices for arms and trainings were relatively high. Another reason was
very difficult economic situation of Czechoslovakia in the mid-1960s and arguably the Ministry of Trade trying to cut costs or trying to make these contracts really profitable. Another reason could be declined of demand from particular partners that are increasingly bankrupt. So, for example, when we're talking about some of the Czechoslovak partners, for example, Guinea, right, or Ghana, right, some of these countries experienced really serious economic problems in the 1960s. So it makes sense why some of these contracts would be on a decline. So it's a very complicated story.
A complicated story that takes another turn in 1964. Exports of military material and weapons are back up as the country is experiencing the Prague Spring, when the USSR softened its grip on Czechoslovakia. The country was becoming slightly more liberal, less strict on its own citizens.
We also found a remarkable document written by the Ministry of Trade where basically these Czechoslovak state businessmen argued that the Prague Spring, the several years in the 1960s which saw a liberalization of the communist regime in Czechoslovakia, were actually really good for arms business, for arms sales and for arms training, because these global South countries saw Czechoslovakia is more liberal than the rest of the Soviet Union and wanted to align with it and were sort of rooting for the liberalization that happened during the Prague Spring, and that this created these sympathies of the global South towards Czechoslovakia, which is of course quite ironic.
The Prague Spring is great for business, everyone's happy, and then only 4 years later, in 1968... 2,000 tanks, 800 army planes, and hundreds of thousands of Soviet, Polish, Hungarian, East German, and Bulgarian soldiers invade their brotherly comrade Czechoslovakia. Just like that, leaving hundreds of Czechoslovaks dead and wounded. The claim here was to suppress the enemy of the state and save Czechoslovakia. But in between the lines, the writing was clear. It was to fortify communism in the country and suppress the liberalization of Czechoslovakia, the Prague Spring. That Prague Spring that was so good for business. And this is where the story ends. Of course, not the story of the former Czechoslovakia and its military assistance programs, but this is the year that the research of Richterova, Telepneva and Pešta comes to. 1968 was a big year. Many things, also in the clandestine sphere, changed. But let's leave that for another time. That was Dr. Natalia Telepneva and Dr. Daniela Richterova. Their article, co-written by Dr. Mikuláš Pešta, is available now in the special issue of the International History Review under the title Banking on Military Assistance, Czechoslovakia's Struggle for Influence to Profit in the Third World, 1955 to 1968. That was, wow, episode 11 of the Secret Struggle for Cold War Dominance podcast, and the last episode of this year. Who would have thought we managed to get all of these done this year? If you like the podcast or this episode, there is a lot more where this came from. Over the past months, we've covered a fake news war in India, the military friendships Tanzania juggled with, a super busy Tanzanian spy, Cuba's secret world, Vietnam and its mastering of the espionage craft. We unveiled the best kept secret, being signals intelligence. We uncovered a secret and very short-term friendship between Czechoslovakia and Cuba, and an unlikely bromance between Morocco and Congo, and we brought to light Polish plans for a spy hub in Cold War Lebanon. You can find all of these and the Secret Struggle for Cold War Dominance podcast on all the popular podcasting platforms like iTunes, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, and many more. Or check out our Twitter, we're at CW Dominance, or Facebook under the name The Secret Struggle for Cold War Dominance. And here we publish a lot of extra material that doesn't make it into the podcast. If you have any questions or comments or feedback regarding the podcast, email us at coldwardominance@gmail.com. All the historical research we have been discussing, highlighting and turning into stories in these episodes were published in the special issue of the renowned International History Review, put together by editors Dr. Daniela Richterova and Dr. Natalia Telepneva. So if you want to read up more on these studies, do check them out here. This podcast is created and produced independently. Interviews, editing, sound design, and all the rest of it is done by me, Katarina Urban Richterova. The artwork for the project is done by Dr. Daniela Richterova. And the idea for the podcast was conceived by the two of us, Daniela and myself. I would like to thank the Warwick Institute of Advanced Study for their contribution to the project. But most importantly, I would like to thank all the academics, historians, and researchers who have spent months, sometimes years, rummaging around old data, memoirs, secret files, and information to bring new stories and histories of the Cold War era into the spotlight and bring us a step closer to the truth about this time. For me personally, it's been eye-opening, super educational, and a huge privilege and honor to speak to these great minds. It's been a great year of Secret Struggles, and we definitely hope to publish more episodes of the incredible Cold War stories in the next year. Okay, before I get teary-eyed, let's wrap this up. A huge thank you to Dr. Daniela Richterova and Dr. Natalia Telepneva for finding the time to talk to me for this week's episode. And of course, thank you for listening to the Secret Struggle for Cold War Dominance podcast. And to lighten things up a bit, at the end, here is our regular nugget of wisdom, tested by history and time.
I think the story highlights how much money becomes a problem for the socialist countries increasingly by the 1980s, and how much they use the Global South, or at least try to use the Global South, to extract profits.
Military and security assistance to the Global South, but also to other countries, is alive and kicking today and will be tomorrow.